Note that if you study history, men have always sought freedom, a society where they could live their lives without having someone control them. And usually there's always been a king or an emperor, a dictator, an authoritarian figure, a chief. Somebody is always telling people how to live. In fact, probably the only two times in all recorded history where there truly has been a freedom without an all-restrictive government was, first of all, the children of Israel when they were living under the Ten Commandments before they insisted on a king, and here in the United States under our constitutional system, imperfect because man is imperfect, but still the finest system of government that mankind has ever known. And so we've been going through the Constitution, we've done the Declaration of Independence, and where did we end up the discussion of the Constitution last?
Well, you know, the heart of the Constitution is, in fact, the idea of the three separate branches of government. And we were talking about finishing up the executive branch, going into the judicial branch, and then summarizing the rest of the body. And hopefully tonight we can go into the Bill of Rights. And it's so appropriate that you bring up, you know, the Old Testament and the Ten Commandments, because Isaiah chapter 33 describes God as a king, God is our judge, God is our lawgiver. And that inspired the founding fathers to describe God that way in the Declaration of Independence. God is the creator and the protector of divine providence, which is the king. God is the lawgiver, the supreme lawgiver, and the supreme judge in the Declaration. And those three attributes of God, which came from the Bible, inspired the founding fathers to these three branches of government. The lawgiver being the legislative branch that we went over in Article 1, and the king being the executive branch that we're going over now, and the judge being the judicial branch that we're going to go over as well. So it's just very appropriate that you brought that up. And where we left off, we were talking about the president. I think we left off in describing him as commander-in-chief, and in this second article, it talks about the president having the power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, and advice and consent was a term of art at the time, to make treaties, but it uses the term provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. Now, this is very important, and this is something that I write about a lot in my book, The Coming Collision, because what we have is a situation where this provision has been watered down and in some cases even ignored. We've seen the situation where certain types of documents that should be considered treaties are called executive agreements and allowed to be viewed as binding documents of our nation without any act whatsoever of the Senate. We've also seen situations where agreements are called trade agreements instead of trade treaties, like NAFTA and GATT, which they really are treaties, and passed with a simple majority instead of a two-thirds vote. And we also see a situation where executive orders are being issued with the kind of language which purports to implement treaties without this two-thirds vote requirement. So this is a very important provision that I think citizens have to become aware of and to be aware that it's not being complied with as it should be.
Amen to that. All right, fine. So let's get on then. Of course, we're now in Article 2. Article 1 is the legislative. Article 2 is the executive.
Right.
And we're talking about then the limitations and the responsibilities of the President of the United States.
That's right. And he shall nominate, and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and counsels, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States.
And we've seen the President recently appoint an ambassador that the Senate didn't want. But when the Senate was in recess, now unfortunately the Senate and Jesse Helms seem to be going right along with the Ambassador Hormel's appointment. Many people were upset because he's an openly avowed homosexual, which is rather embarrassing to the United States that we would appoint an open, out-of-the-closet homosexual. But the president did that when, as I recall, the Senate was in session, didn't he?
Did it when a recess appointment, which I don't think we should tolerate as citizens, and you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, it appears as though our representatives are not holding the president accountable, they're not following this document, which is a very sad thing. Also, the NATO treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty, has some very specific provisions in it. Now, it was ratified by the Senate, but at their 50th anniversary, they issued documents and made statements that they had changed that treaty, but that was never approved by our representatives in the Senate according to this provision. And we have to, as citizens, insist that these treaties cannot be changed without the proper procedure being followed. And hopefully we get more involved and informed so we don't even allow the Senate to approve many of these treaties that they've already approved. But it also says the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone in the courts of law or in heads of departments. So the inferior officers are officers lower in rank, and Congress can make laws determining how they should be appointed is what that's about. And the president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate. Here's this loophole. By granting commissions, authorizations to perform certain duties and take on certain powers, which shall expire at the end of their next session. Now, this is what this recess appointment is, a temporary appointment. It's supposed to be a temporary appointment or commission to offices which require Senate confirmation. And I think Bill Land Lee was another one of these recess appointments. And we have to be sure that it's temporary. And he shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. This is where the State of the Union speech comes from. And recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient, and he may on extraordinary occasions convene both houses or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. He shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And this is a very important provision, because this is reflected in the oath, the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Faithful to whom? Faithful to the people. That means that when the president is issuing memoranda or presidential directives or executive orders or deploying troops, he's supposed to be faithful to the people, and he's supposed to be executing laws that are already on the books. He's not supposed to be making laws. And so this is a very important provision. And shall commission all the officers of the United States.
I have one of Bill Clinton's associates was talking about executive orders, and I think his phrase was a stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool. In other words, Bill Clinton makes laws with a stroke of the pen, and that's kind of cool. Didn't you quote that in one of your books?
I did. That was Paul Begala, the former senior White House advisor, and it showed just this flippant attitude about the executive order practice of the Clinton administration, where they take failed legislation, repackage it as an executive order, and literally act as a one-man Congress, which, when one man makes law with the stroke of a pen, that's what we call a monarchy or a dictatorship, and that's exactly what our founding fathers were moving away from. They did not want to see power vested in any one branch, let alone any one individual, because they believed in the biblical view of man, original sin, the fall of man, and we should have a healthy suspicion about anyone vested with power. And then the Constitution goes on, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for, and conviction of treason, bribery, and this language we heard so much of, other high crimes and misdemeanors. And we heard that the president's conduct in having sex with a volunteer intern in our Oval Office and then lying about it under oath and attempting to obstruct justice, that did not, quote, rise to the level of impeachment. And that's what we heard over and over and over again.
And, of course, I certainly think he should have been tried for bribery, for taking money from the Chinese Communist government, which was funneling money to get him elected, and certainly for treasonous acts, transferring of our secret technology to our enemies, to our sworn enemies. But those issues were never raised. So basically now we've covered Section 4 of Article 2, which concludes Article 2, and now we're ready for Article 3.
Article 3, which is, again, the three branches of government being legislative, executive, and judicial. And I think the Founding Fathers did this in order. They intended for the legislative branch to be the most powerful. And, of course, today our legislative branch is acting like the weakest branch. They allow the other branches to usurp their power, and they even dish off and delegate their lawmaking power to bureaucratic agencies. But the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. And the judges, both of the Supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior. And the good behavior has a specific meaning, that judges, when they are not serving the people properly, should be impeached, and shall at stated times receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. It's interesting, Alexander Hamilton wanted senators to serve on good behavior and not have term limits, but not have terms at all, because that's how much Alexander Hamilton viewed this as a republic. But the Supreme Court and other federal judges are appointed by the president. That's why the presidency is a very, very important office, because it will influence the judiciary, and it has so greatly by the appointments that Bill Clinton has made. And they cannot be dismissed by the president once they're in, but they can be impeached by the House in a similar proceeding that we saw, and then tried by the Senate, and if found guilty, then dismissed from office. And so the idea here was, why do we have judges serve on good behavior, was to keep them independent of the political world. They were supposed to be interpreting law and not to be influenced by public opinion, not to be influenced by social and cultural fads of the time, but their role was to interpret the law according to that maxim that we talked about, and that is the legislative intent of that particular law. And in the case of the Constitution, that's the original intent of the Constitution, which is reflected by the Founding Fathers, the Federalist Papers, Blackstone Commentaries, and that sort of thing. The judicial power will extend to all cases in law and equity. And law and equity is just a term of art that it has to do with the way common law arose in England. The courts of equity are courts that would render decisions like injunctions or specific performance, getting involved in non-monetary kinds of civil decisions, as opposed to courts of law that would deal with damages and things like that in civil cases. And it would, law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, to all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and councils, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. And admiralty and maritime jurisdiction covers those things that are done upon and relating to to the sea, like commerce and navigation and injuries in the sea, and to controversies. And this section sets up where federal courts can have jurisdiction, where the United States shall be a party, where there are controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof, foreign state citizens or subjects. So the federal courts cannot get involved in a case where two people are suing each other and they're in the same state, and it doesn't involve a specific kind of federal statute. Now, if it involves copyright and bankruptcy, as we looked at earlier, that goes in exclusively in federal court. So not every case can go in federal court.
But it seems that the federal court has expanded its jurisdiction. And, for instance, how it was able to justify centralizing all power in Washington, D.C. and minimizing the power of our states, how it was able to find a wall of separation between church and state when none had existed prior to 1962, or find a woman's right to abortion when none had existed under confidentiality status prior to 1973 with Roe versus Wade. Suddenly we find our Supreme Court interfering in all sorts of matters dealing with life, liberty, and property, which were previously matters which only the state would deal with.
No, that's true. And when we get to the Bill of Rights, we're going to talk more about that, but that's that judicial activism that we were talking about, where basically the judiciary is, in fact, encroaching on the lawmaking function, because the judiciary is supposed to interpret the law. They're not supposed to be making the law. That, again, is legislation without representation by these people that are appointed for life and we don't elect, and they should not be making law at all, especially when they start twisting the Constitution and using the word implied, a very dangerous word. They start implying things. And then they'll say, this implication implies something else, and pretty soon they're basically rewriting the Constitution. The 11th Amendment changed this a little bit, that a citizen of one state cannot sue a state in federal court. Now, and it says, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction, and that means the lawsuit begins at the Supreme Court. But in all other cases, the Supreme Court is an appellate court, which means it's appealed to, both as to law and fact, and with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. And this is an important provision, because the Declaration of Independence stated that many American colonists had been deprived of trials by jury, right in the body of the Constitution. The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crimes have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed. So the trial by jury was a very important right, and it's still important today, because it's one of the safeguards when judges have grown too powerful. There's something very comforting about knowing that 12 ordinary people from the community can make a decision. The problem has been that the 12 people have not been informed civically as they should, but I think we can remedy that. And then Section 3 talks about, as you said, Dr. Stan, treason. And treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, and this is some key language, giving them aid and comfort. And the idea here was to protect people who were accused of treason, because treason was a crime that was used by the British Crown to torture people and kill them. So no person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act. And overt meant an open or public act, and or on confession. in open court. So there was a little stronger burden there, and goes on to say that Congress shall have the power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder, and attainder means the loss of a person's civil rights, because he's been sentenced to death or outlawed, no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood. And that means that a blood relative or family member of a person found guilty shall not be held guilty because of his relative's treason. Again, coming from abuses under the British Crown. Or forfeiture, giving up something as a penalty, except during the life of the person attainted. And that's punished, in essence. And the forfeiture issue, we just had some legislation to reform some very terrible laws that still need further reform, where people's property are confiscated when they're just accused of crimes. And it's another one of these areas where they've departed from constitutional protection. And we really, really need this. But it was an overwhelming 10-1 vote in the House. And so it's a very positive step that this forfeiture law has been addressed. And Article 4 describes how the states will deal with each other and how new states may be admitted to the United States. And it guarantees that each state will be protected by federal government from invasion. And Article 5 describes the procedure of how new amendments may be added to the Constitution. And Article 6, it deals with debts that are owed by the United States prior to 1788 when the Constitution was adopted. So the article also provides for the oath for government officials, and Article 7 gives the steps that would to be followed for the adoption of this Constitution. But one thing I want to point out in Article 6, and Dr. Stan, you're very familiar with this, it's in the first paragraph of Article 6, or it's actually the second. And what it says, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and judges in every state shall be bound thereby. And anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Now, as you know, in my book and in on your show, I know you've talked about it many times, is this famous quote of the Secretary of State under Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles, who stated that treaties make federal law and they make domestic law, and they, because they are the supreme law of the land, he talked about this Article 6, they cut across and supersede the very Constitution itself and the Bill of Rights. And that is wrong. That is completely wrong, because in reading the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist Number 75 that treaties are agreements between the sovereign and the sovereign, and they should not prescribe rules from the sovereign to the subject. What he was saying is treaties are not supposed to be legislation, and there is no way that the Founding Fathers would have intended for treaties to accomplish anything beyond this limited government concept that they had set up. So, in other words, Congress cannot accomplish through a treaty what it can't do through legislation. And so this statement by John Foster Dulles, which unfortunately has been embraced by many at the international level, which you can tell by just looking at the contents of these treaties, is absolutely illicit and wrong. And it's very important for citizens to understand that.
It certainly is, and of course, at one time they tried to clarify that with the Bricker Amendment under the Eisenhower administration, and of course, Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, being an internationalist, was able to defeat the Bricker Amendment by one vote, and the Bricker Amendment would have said that treaties do not supersede our Constitution. And so we need people to really understand this, and we need an outcry, because of course, what in essence has happened is now, as ever more treaties are being made and passed, what we are doing is allowing international bodies to come up with legislation on their own that will take away our constitutional freedom. And most people don't understand that, but this is exactly where we're headed.
That's right. It's legislation without representation, or legislation with phony representation, because
right.
These NGOs that purport to represent us do not represent us at all. And with that, you know, I wanted to move into the Bill of Rights, and I think that we can really focus in on so much on the First Amendment, because particularly in the very first sentence of the First Amendment, which begins with these just in words of enormity, almost like they're thunder, Congress shall make no law. And those are beautiful, because there's limited government being written. The Founding Fathers started out with a constitution without any Bill of Rights, because they looked at the first sentence following the preamble, which said, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. They're looking at, hey, we're only giving the government those powers that are herein granted. We didn't give them any power respecting an establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof, or abridging freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people to assemble. So we really don't even need a Bill of Rights.
Because it was assumed that those were God-given rights.
That's right.
And so these were not granted by the state. They couldn't be taken away by the state. They couldn't be restricted by the state. But there were those who said, well, there'll be some people down the line, if you don't specifically stipulate it, they'll just twist the wording and misuse it. And there were others who said, no, if you put anything in our Constitution or a Bill of Rights about religion down the line, somebody's going to twist that. And that's exactly what they've done with the First Amendment, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing. It is absolutely amazing.
That's because people do not understand it was a restriction on the power of Congress, not on the restriction of the power of the state or the local community.
That's right. As a matter of fact, it's a great misnomer when people talk about their constitutional rights. So they'll say, the rights that the Constitution gives me, because there are no such things as rights that come from the Constitution. The rights are already within us, implanted by our Creator, and the Constitution merely sets forth that the government is restrained from interfering with those rights we already have. So that's a very important thing, and school children need to learn that. And the first fundamental right is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And this is a big one, because, you know, this is people are always shocked when they sit down and they actually read this, and they say, well, where is this amendment that talks about the separation of church and state? I don't see it here. That's because it's not there.
It was created by our Supreme Court justices, who had, unfortunately, a spiritual and political agenda. We're going to have to take a quick break. We'll give you just 3 minutes to get a cup of coffee or a glass of water, and then we'll be back here with the last half hour of this fascinating discussion of the Constitution of the United States, which is the very foundation of our freedom. The Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, are the foundation upon which our freedom rests.